Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. We're here to bring you ideas, concepts, and the occasional guest to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today, I have, as promised, Dr. Scott Baum, because there are issues about love that I want to look at. I want to see how love really affects you, and I thought I'd pull on Scott Baum because he's one of those professionals, one of those guys who seem to have had enough experience in working with people and their bodies. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Armand. Good to be here.
Let's start with this whole list. We've been talking about love, and we've been talking about love that gets lost and love that gets found and falling out of love. Is love essential to well-being? Is it essential, or is it whipped cream on the cake, or tofu cream on the cake, whatever you prefer?
Good question. I think I think that in general people have somewhat unthought through ideas and feelings. If one can think through a feeling, which I think one can, thinking being a biological activity, about love. And since it's so crucial, I think, in our lives, it's hard sometimes to really think about it in a more careful way. I think when we look at infants and we look at people's bodies who, as infants, have been loved or not loved, we see very clear evidence that being loved, and I think maybe later on we'll talk about loving as well, are essential elements to a person's well-being.
Well, yeah, essential, yes. So you think that it is really essential?
Absolutely essential.
That was the answer. How is it essential? Let's talk about infancy and childhood, okay? We know that a child has to be protected. There are a lot of parents who can feel they protect the child, they take care of the child, they nurture the child in a certain way, they put the child in child care. Where is the love element? What is that? How is that essential to the child's well-being?
I think that from my observations and my experience myself and with the people that I can be close to, love is an energetic force. I wouldn't pretend that I can explain it, but it is an energetic force, and it has specific effects on an organism, on a human organism, and on other organisms. And what happens, I think, is that when a child is loved, it allows that child to relax her or his boundaries and become suffused with her or his own energy.
So how would it manifest? Let's say I remember I worked with Dr. Peter Hogan a while. He was a Reichian. He was really interested in the development of the body. He had an interesting theory, Scott. He said, if you have stomach problems, you have problems with nurturance. If you have problems on the right side of your body, you have problems with aggression. If you have problems on the left side of your body, you have problems with defending yourself. If you have troubles with your shoulders and your back, on your shoulders, he said, it means you're carrying too much weight. He said that people will actually manifest their emotional problems in their physical symptoms. You believe that?
Yes, I do believe that. Yeah. I think sometimes it's complicated with any one individual.
Right. It might not just be one simple thing.
And one thing may be the result of, and almost always is, many forces. But I think you can draw certain generalizations. For example, infants who are loved tend to be able to relax, to soothe themselves when they're upset, to go to some internal place of calm where they take the feelings they've been given together with their own feelings, and they're able to settle down.
So if a person felt as a child they really felt loved, they might develop an inner world with an inner place of calm. It makes so much sense.
It does to me.
And if they don't have that inner world with the inner place of calm, you know, if you don't have that first, you know, you're it's likely that later in life you don't know what it is to try to find yourself. You don't know what it means to go inside and say, when somebody says calm down, you wonder what that is.
Exactly.
How could I calm down? There is no calm to go to. There's no place.
That's right. There is no place of calm and peace That's not to say that people can't develop it, but I think that is the gift, or at least one of the gifts of love, that the child gives to his parents as well, or her parents, and that's given to the child.
My guest is Dr. Scott Baum. We work together. I mean, one day a week we work together here at the DeMille Center. Dr. Scott Baum is a bioenergetic psychotherapist and clinical psychologist who's a, he does a lot of things. He's got lots of stuff on the wall. And Scott's knowledgeable about the human body and the manifestations of the human body. We're going to give an example of this, but I want to stick first on the early childhood development. Mm-hmm. You don't have the proper love. What does that mean? Let's say you have the love of your mother but not your father. How do you imagine, Scott, that that would manifest later in a physiological syndrome or disorder?
Oh, boy, that's a very big and, I think, important subject about which we haven't really talked enough. I don't think that the two parents are interchangeable. And so there are unique aspects of loving that come from each parent and unique aspects of identification. So the child who's loved by her or his mother but not by the father grows up to be someone who can't identify with a loving father, who doesn't have a place, say, in relationships with men, for example, of a kind of inner knowing, which you were talking about earlier, that it's possible to be in relationship with men and be in that calm place and be safe and be supported, be allowed to be expansive. I think this is one of the big problems in our culture.
And I think one of the things you find as a manifestation is that when a person like this who has had a relationship with only a mother and not a father and doesn't have this male comfort you're talking about, they go into the world, problems with authority figures.
Absolutely.
Automatically. You could see other manifestations, which would be that they would be unable to really shoulder a giant burden on the outside. If they shoulder the burden for their mothers, for their wives. Mm-hmm. But dealing with and competing with and being in a male world becomes difficult.
Yes.
They could wind up being counterculturists. They could wind up being just fighting the whole thing. I'm fighting Dad.
Absolutely.
And the body, therefore, would show perhaps a peaceful digestive system, right? The mm-hmm. the mother stuff, mom nurtures you and makes your digestive system work, but a very bent defensive system, such as the back, that which needs to protect you.
In bioenergetic terms, a general body rigidity. I have a client like this who's exactly what you describe, and I actually wrote some in a paper. I described him as being like an egg. He has this very soft, incredibly creative, feelingful yolk. When he plays music, it's extraordinary the feelings he can elicit. But around that is this rigid set of muscles, which are very much his identification with a critical, unloving father. And he can't really find a way to move that yoke out into the world. And that's what love does for little babies. It allows them to soften their tissue, to suffuse their tissue with energy and blood, to let it all come to the surface, to expand out into the environment, to let the environment come into them. I mean, this is a miracle of evolutionary planning, because it really allows the child to interact from inside herself or himself with the environment. And when that's not there, you get these kinds of rigidities.
Let's try the opposite of that. How about women who are close to their fathers but don't feel safe with their mothers? Let's think about how that might manifest, right? They're close with the male part, that they're good with. But usually, I guess you would find, I know I would find, digestive disorders.
Absolutely.
Right.
Eating problems, problems of appearance, a kind of desperate anxiety about guilt because there's a tremendous competition set up there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a client of mine who reflects just what you're talking about. And a terrible sense of loss, actually, on both sides, that somehow the merging and the bonding, which are functions of love in the early infant, is not present with that other parent. It creates tremendous tension.
One of the interesting things, and this goes all the way back, there's so little of Sigmund Freud nowadays that even gets mentioned. But one of the things Freud did mention was that asthma, he saw asthma as the suppressed cry for help from the mother. He said asthma is almost always the breath being suffocated. So what we used to do in therapy, the work that we would do with asthmatic people, is we'd have them just get in a soundproof room and scream for their mothers. Mm-hmm. And it invariably was more effective with their breathing. Their breathing opened up.
Yes. Well, that's a really a perfect example of what I'm talking about, because the lungs are visceral. It's not a tension in the muscles. It's a tension deep inside what we used to believe when I was coming up through school were involuntary muscles. Now we've opened our minds enough to know that there is almost no such thing in the human body, that with sufficient awareness and effort one can contact and work with those quote-unquote involuntary systems. But that's the level on which the contraction takes place. Stanley Kellerman once made the point that when a person breathes, they are literally taking the environment into their bodies. If that environment is noxious or toxic or cold or harsh or ungiving, that's what's going into their bodies at the level of their breath. And so they're breathing that in quite literally. And then the contractions occur at that level. If the feeling of loving, which I think is an energetic feeling or process, isn't there to support the opening and the spreading of the tissue.
Well, let's take a look at the effect of violence on the human body. Mm-hmm. How does somebody being beaten, someone who is, you know, a lot of people have this heavy hand, childhood and child rearing, one of the things about it is that there's a group of people now reemerging who are saying that the only discipline that seems to count is corporal discipline. And they're actually advocating corporal discipline again, minor. They're saying minor, you know, slaps on the hands and smack them on the bottom, that kind of stuff. Being beaten as a child, being punished in a physical way.
Yes.
Does that manifest in really clear, understandable ways that you can just see in a person when you greet them for almost the first time? I could always tell somebody who's been beaten.
I think so, yes. Sure. I think you see it either in the direct response or in the compensation, the reaction to that response. I think what people miss when they talk about physical abuse, because that's what it is. I mean, if I climbed into the ring with Mike Tyson and he beat me up, nobody would say that's boxing. I'm a little guy, by the way. You can't see this out there, but I'm a little guy. I wouldn't get in the ring with him. Is that what works, what underlies what makes it work is that it's intimidating. And one can generally see in people the results of intimidation in the way they look down or look away, in the look in their eyes, or in the need they have immediately to come forward and challenge. And their shoulders are up and their body is inflated and they're ready to go. They're ready to fight about anything. That's the chip on the shoulder.
When it's a man who's been physically abused, it's kind of always amazing, because as I hug them, right, if I hug this man, let's say we've just spent an intense hour of going over his life and the guy's ripped out every sore that he's got and he wants to talk about it and he's been crying in my office. At the end of a session, I might hug him goodbye, right? I'm hugging him and his body stiffens.
Right.
And that stiffness, I realized, is his holding back his body from being beaten. Yes. Very often the face. Very often you'll see people, and a lot of you people will recognize it in the people you know, when you hug them, they hold their face away, almost as if they're going to get slapped. And they keep that part out. Or other manifestations, other things. I know that we have this one case I wanted to talk to you about, a man who is a very successful man. He is very effective in life. He's very powerful. He gets everything done. He is financially successful. He's got a good mind. He takes care of himself physically. He's working on his relationships, but he's got one bug, and that's his back. No matter what he does, he's been to chiropractors, he's been to natural healers, he's done the dietary thing, he's gone everywhere to have his back taken care of. And he comes to me and he says, Armand, could it be psychological? Yes, in his childhood he was beaten. Mm-hmm. How would you work with a man? Now this man comes to you and we're going to make an assumption. Because you're a psychologist, you're going to make an assumption. There's a body-mind connection. You have to.
I mean,
that's your
do.
Business. Right. That's what you do for a living.
Yeah.
Right? If he went to a nutritionist, they'd say it's a nutritional connection.
I would
right?
think.
If
sure.
he went to a chiropractor, they're going to say you need an adjustment. You know, so as a psychologist, naturally you're going to think that. But how do you work it? How do you work with it to uncover whether this physiological problem is psychological in origin and psychological in maintenance?
I love the way you put this. You said he has a bug, and I think that's so apt. It gave me an image when you said it, which was of someone in a suit of armor with a little tiny bore hole at his lower back where this little thing keeps drilling a hole. And that's the only place, that's the truly the Achilles tendon for this man, the true place of vulnerability.
That's perfect because in a way he is a perfectionist.
Uh-huh.
And everything in his life, if there's an imperfection anyway, he wants to correct it.
Well, so that really fits.
So this is almost a gift.
Right.
But I hate to call it a gift because, you know, having a bad back.
Oh, it's horrible.
I'll tell you a story about a man who once came to me who was impotent. And he couldn't get an erection with women. So he came to me and he was sitting in my, he was sitting with me and he said to me, and I said, well, you know, let's talk about your feeling towards women. And after a little examination, it turns out he's really terrified of women,
uh-huh.
Really terrified. So his impotence was serving him not being vulnerable to women. And we really, it was clear to both of us after he talked about it. So I said, well, this impotence, you know, in a way, it's a gift. And he said, how would you like to have it for your birthday?
Right. Well said. Yes, I know that.
So, yeah. In a way, the lower back is a gift in as much as it's a signal.
Yeah, and it points toward a vulnerability. And he has the option of pursuing the vulnerability. If he wanted to pursue it with me, I can imagine something like the following unfolding. I might suggest to him to stand up, feel the floor under his feet, and see if I could help him to align himself so that his body aligned from the knees to the hips to the shoulders to the top of his head, pretty much over the center of his gravity. The reason for that is that a person standing like that really begins to feel their body in relationship to gravity, what they have to do to be here now, because we're constantly in relationship to gravity, making very small modifications and minor changes. And then, just listening to you talk about him, the thing that strikes me about this little bug that's digging into his lower back, that's pulling, if one visualizes the muscles of the lower back, when they are not working properly, the pelvis, the person's pelvis, swings back behind them. It gets out of the action. That's one of the effects of those muscles working properly.
How would a person walk around if that were... that? How would they know it?
They would know that they have a slight sway back down there, and they would feel themselves slightly pitched backwards, with their face maybe pointed more forward as they try to counterbalance. They wouldn't feel themselves as if one is sitting on horseback moving along with all the parts lined up. Now, if this man was willing to and felt comfortable to do this and was standing up like that, I might suggest to him to actively use his abdominal muscles to engage them, feel them working, and use them to pull his pelvis forward into line so that now his knees, his hips, his shoulders, and the top of his head are lined up. Generally, when that happens, the person's way of rigidly holding themselves in position starts to break up. There's a little bit of movement, a little vibration, a little bit of feeling. There's also a deeper breath because now the abdominal muscles and the lower back muscles are acting like a girdle to hold in the person's visceral organs. And that leaves room for the lungs to fill up. If you try it, if you're sort of standing around at home and you want to try this, try it out, and I think you'll find that if you line yourself up, you'll almost immediately take a deep breath.
Well, the people who could do that right now, right, if they were standing,
yeah,
right, now they would stand and they would say, where am I out of line?
Well,
what do you pay attention to? You pay attention to the plumb line from the ceiling?
Yeah, start with your feet. Feel your feet parallel to each other and standing so that your weight is in the middle of your foot, not on the heel and not on the ball. Soften your knees so that they're not stiff. Now feel your hips and see if you can line your hips up with your knees. The more you're used to doing this, the more able you are.
How do you line up your hips with your knees?
You bring your hips forward. Usually for most people, it's bring them forward a little bit so that you feel a little bit of tension in your quadriceps, the muscles in front of your legs.
Mm-hmm.
That usually means that you've engaged the weight and you're now actually holding your weight up instead of standing rigid. And then see if you can bring your shoulder blades back a little bit. Most people have to. And at the same time, drop your shoulders so that they're not way up high around your ears. Or drop your shoulders, shoulder blades back. And now you're more likely than not standing fairly in alignment, except that you may feel now that tension in your lower back.
Any particular movement with the head? Is the head
well,
forward,
the head comes
hanging?
Last. Yeah, the okay. head comes last. And so if you use your stomach muscles a little bit now and rock your pelvis forward toward the front of your body, and now if you can imagine a small string attached to the top of your head, and that string is attached to the ceiling, and there's a very gentle tug on that string, so that now your whole body is elongated and straight and your knees are soft. And I think you'll find if you do that, you will almost automatically go. Now, if this man you're talking about does that, my expectation is that that will free up some of what's keeping him in the rigid position with his pelvis locked backwards.
Okay, now we don't need a psychotherapist to do body alignment, right?
No, certainly not.
So where does the psychotherapy become a part of this?
That's a very good question. The psychotherapy is a part of it all the way through. I'm only doing this as an experiment for him to experience his own experience. What happens now? Does he see his father in front of him? Does he feel like I've pushed him around and told him what to do? Does he expect me now to tell him what to do forever? Am I now the figure who's going to dominate him the way his father did? Am I the mother who stood by and watched him get hit, let's say, and didn't help out? Is he in contact with this experience? Does it cause him heart pain? Is he going to go into grief? Will he withdraw now and not talk to me? I have to pay attention to all of that as it's happening and be available for all of it. It's not my mission to create this new posture with him. This was an experiment designed to intensify his awareness of himself and to give him some room to express what's there. We might do it 100 times. We might never do it again.
So one of the ideas of this kind of psychotherapy, which, by the way, I'm going to, even though I'm asking the questions about it, we do have it here practiced by 2 people, right,
yep.
who do it here specifically. But the idea of it is that you first align a person or try to find a natural place for a person to be. Then you're going to see if it has an effect on them to make this change. And then you look at what comes up, what emotions come up, or what thinking comes up.
In this case, absolutely. That makes sense.
And then does their thinking wind up? And then we have to look at the transference. What thinking do they project onto you? And how do they now say, you are the doctor, you're doing this with me, you're forcing me to do this, you know, you're loving me, you're not loving me, I expect this of you. All of that becomes a manifestation of why the body's like this in the first place.
Absolutely.
So by changing a body shift, let's say you changed your body to have a person work with their left hand instead mm-hmm. of their right hand. Is that something that bioenergetics might do? Might you shift the dominant body side? Because I know you work with a horse, don't you?
With a stool that people breathe on, yeah. Well, you know what? The truth of the matter is that the techniques are creative. I invent them as I go along. I mean, there are some that I like and I use regularly, but what I'm mostly doing is trying to be so present with that person that I can either feel in my body or see in theirs directions to go, ways to open themselves to their own experience or express it, which is so difficult.
What do you mean express?
Well, it can be expressed.
Opening their mouth and making a sound.
Making a sound, saying what's really on their mind, hitting, kicking, reaching, talking to me about their experience.
Doesn't it hurt if they hit and kick you?
Yes, I have. That's my only ground rule, as my clients know, is you can't beat me up and you can't bust up my furniture. Other than that, you can do pretty much anything you want in my office.
But screaming, I've seen it so often that just opening your voice for the first time. I heard today, I did an interview with a woman, and I heard a scream come from her body that you would have never suspected she was capable of.
Isn't that amazing?
And you hear it for the first time.
Yes.
And there's a part of me as therapist, you know, when I hear that, I weep. I say, This is the pain that they've been carrying for so many years, for 30, 40, 50 years, and it's having its first expression.
Well, you know, there is significant research, and it's almost like we have to keep saying this over and over again, that demonstrates that the tears a person sheds in pain, or tears they shed in grief, or tears they shed in joy, if they are so fortunate to have those, are chemically different from each other. Everything we do somatically has its own meaning and significance. I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that this is garbage to be gotten out of a person's system. This is who we are. This is our very essence.
If you don't have your voice and you don't have your right to express your pain when you feel your pain, if you've closed yourself down from that, it's going to manifest in a broken body.
Yes.
Your body's going to be broken. It's going to be... It's going to have little pieces that are just strained. Your aches and pains are going to be in particular parts of your body.
And love is the platform from which that process begins, the process of supporting and nurturing a person's emergence as who they are in their infancy, with that kind of space for the child to expand, to become unbounded, to reach out, to make their own relationship with the environment.
You know, when we think about the absence of love, or the opposite of love, which is a virtual parental hatred, which they manifest by, you know, trying to structure a child and beat a child and control the child, it just becomes kind of amazing when you see the effect of it.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you Truth in Radio.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Scott Baum. We're going to be back with you in a little bit. We'll be talking about how love manifests in the human body. Amazing. This is WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. I bring you another form of my rhythmic world. This comes from some amazing people. I'll explain more of it to you. It's from the Hungarian born George Ginda. Just listen in. It's not what you're used to. Think about the cooperation. I like this because it kind of sounds like the human bones playing with each other. You know, the xylophone always does. This is for you, my friends. Thank you. That deep drum gets me the most. Minnow Sinulu and George Jinda, J-I-N-D-A. Boom, 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 boom. You don't know what it's like to just be the guy who plays the deep drum, you know, just keeps one rhythm going. It's kind of amazing, you know, all you do is boom, boom, boom. Some people do that, you know. You know, the bassist of a band is always kind of an amazing guy, the guy who plays the bass, because he's playing the rhythm behind everything. He's the key person of a band. And the one who carries the primary rhythm is the bassist, and yet never gets the accolades. People don't really think that he's the greatest one, you know, but everybody depends on him, and a lot of people like that. They like being the rhythm behind you. The music, the tempo behind you, they don't necessarily have to be out front. Armand DeMille here, WBAI, Dr. Scott Baum. We're talking about the body-mind manifestations of love. You know, how does it happen? Does loving really make a difference? Or does this mean if you get older in life and you're living alone and you don't have anybody to love you that you can't be okay with your body, Scott?
No, I don't think it means that at all. I think that, in fact, what we're talking about is that this is the platform for developing a self-loving process. It's just as important to be able to love, to have receivers, as it is to be loved. I think that's missed often, that the infant who's swelling and being suffused with her or his energy is also moving that energy out, and it's being received, and there's tremendous pleasure in that and in the cycle of reciprocity. I give and I take and I take and I give, and they're really not distinguishable from each other.
It's not the love of the present that we're talking about. Yes, it's nice to have a mate in your life if you're lucky enough to have a mate, but what if your mate dies? What if you don't have a mate? What if you're living alone? What if you choose to live alone, or you're living alone by default? By default of the fact that there's nobody out there that you could find who's decent.
Well, my wife, when I was writing one of these articles I was referring to, made the point, and I think very astutely, that what happens for small children with respect to love is that through their parents, if their parents are capable of it, children are connected to the benevolence in the universe. And that is there for them regardless of who else is or is not around. And it's the ability to draw on that that gives people a center and some peace. It's that person playing the bass in the background. I think it's one of the reasons why mothers, the mothering function, whether it's performed by a man and almost always by women, is so devalued, because it is that background noise. And it is that sound of the drum beating, and it does provide the background in which we all function. It's the matrix, and we tend to devalue it.
What happens to someone when they're not loved, Scott? And I guess we're talking about during the early years. What happens when a person's not loved in childhood? What kind of symptoms do they wind up with?
A person who really is...
May wind up with... I'm sorry, I don't want to stick you with that. But
I understand that. But there are some generalizations to be made, because here we have a person whose whole body is organized to continue to seek out what they haven't had. So it's very much like a plant. When a plant doesn't get enough water or nutrient, it begins to shrivel. The evolutionary system that we have says... preserve the center first, allow the periphery to die if necessary, but certainly to shrivel. So this is a person who begins to contract in on themselves. They don't have enough nutrients. They don't have enough nurturance in the way you were talking earlier. They can't allow their internal organs to expand. They can't spread out. They can't relax. They're in a constant, tight, contracted state. And one sees it in the collapse of the chest. What's the collapse of the chest? It's a chest that's narrowed, where the diaphragm is contracted and the person is bent over just like you would expect of somebody who's been starving, who hasn't had enough to eat and drink, who hasn't had enough sunlight. And that hunch in the shoulders and the collapse in the chest, the stiffening up in the legs and knees to try to hold this person up as they walk through life, desperately looking everywhere with their face out in front, looking everywhere, craving this nourishment, this basic nourishment.
Talk about that looking everywhere, because there's a look in their eyes that has like a desperation.
Yes, it's
over
a hunger.
Time. And
absolutely.
And what you're saying is that's the hunger. Yes. So you can picture the people who over time are contracting more and more.
Right.
And they're building the shell around the sensitive organs, the heart, the stomach, you know,
that's
the things
right.
that you need to maintain life. You could break
right.
every bone in your body, almost every bone in your body.
Almost.
And you're going to protect those innards.
That's right.
But you're protecting your innards. Now, on the other hand, and what are you protecting? You're protecting your only felt sense of comfort that's left. You sacrifice the bones. You
that's
sacrifice
right.
the muscles.
All the structure goes. And then what happens is that person reaches a point where they really can go out on their own. But now everything is so contracted and they are so depleted that they no longer have the digestive system to take this energy and allow it to spread their tissue and expand them. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, bringing the feeding tube. It's a matter of the person beginning to see how contracted they are. And
mm-hmm.
slowly, against the tremendous pain of the deprivation and the loss and the resentment that they haven't been fed, begin to try to expand those tissues a little bit. It's very difficult.
And doing that again in therapy.
Again and again.
Again and again in therapy, to have the person work with it. What about people who've got, you know, sometimes you see people whose shoulders are bent over and they've kind of developed a little growth on their back where they've fused their spines and things like that have begun to happen. Do you think that even if you worked with them, you would unearth that you think you could change it? Have you seen it change?
Sure.
Have you seen people straighten up after being bent over?
Yes.
Talk about it. What have you seen? Real stuff, not just theory.
I've seen people, and I've experienced it in myself. I've had the experience of feeling like my lungs were just filled with adhesions, that they were the front to the back. There was no movement. And after many years of work, I've actually had the feeling that one day in a session that I can remember to this day of taking a deep breath and suddenly realizing that the adhesions weren't there in the same way, that I could fill my lungs. It was an astounding experience.
Mm.
And that's on the inside. And it's important to work with the inside of the body and not only with the surface musculature. But sure, I've seen people, what you're describing is a yoke on a person's shoulders, which causes them to raise up and hold up that burden no matter what. And I've seen people let the burden down and drop their shoulders and spread them. How much a person can do that, how durable it is, that depends. There's no
I've seen
answer.
It. Even if there's extreme calcification or there's bone changes, it's kind of amazing when you get to the stuff that's been holding it there.
Yes.
Right? That which holds it there and builds it there and changes it. When that goes away, something else happens in the body.
Absolutely.
Something comes in to rechange it. I remember one experience. I was working with a patient. And the patient who had serious disorder around his heart, and we did some visualizations, and at one point he was sitting on a couch, and he said, I feel torn between my child and my wife. And I said, is that like the torn you've always felt? And he said, yeah, I was always torn between my mother and my father. And I said, and what's that like? How do you picture it? And he said, I picture my heart being pulled in two directions. So I said, visualize yourself being pulled in two directions. And he literally described that he felt like he was breaking in half.
Yeah.
Like there was a thing going down his bottom, a fissure that was going down his entire spine. And he felt himself being pulled in both directions. And he felt it going right through his heart. And he screamed from the pain of it until he finally did something corrective, which is he turned around and he shouted to his parents, stop pulling me.
Mm.
Please let me be whole. And a funny thing happened. His arrhythmic patterns went away.
Yeah.
His heart changed.
I'm sure that's so.
Amazing stuff.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that people like me who do body-oriented psychotherapy believe is that these are not metaphors.
Right.
That what people are describing in whatever fashion we can with our limited vocabularies, and it's unrefined, but it's still exactly what the experience is. On some level, that is what it is, and I tend to work with that in a very concrete, direct way. It doesn't mean that there aren't other elements of imagination and a relationship going on all the time, but I tend to work with that expression as a direct expression of what's happened.
Well, let's look at one of the common metaphorical statements, which is, I feel like I'm falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, I used to do workshops on the fear of losing control. I feel like I'm losing control. The way that sounds to everybody is that they would lose control, and there are so many different ways of working with it. One way I used to do is I would say, here's an interesting question, those of you who believe you have a fear of losing control. If you lost control, how would it look? How would it manifest? And people come up with different fantasies. One is, if I lose control, I'm going to be silent. I'm going to lay down. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to be quiet. I'm going to be in a little pod, and I will never move. Another one will say, if I lose control, I will be raging all the time. I will be angry all the time. And the interesting thing is, when I ask the following question, it works. And if you lost control in that fashion, which of your parents would most feel offended or hurt by it?
Mm-hmm.
And you find the connection every time.
Mm-hmm.
And they will say things like, they will say, well, my mother, you know, is the one who fears me being this way. And you'll see that they've held themselves back in a kind of dedication to their mom. Okay, and another form of it. You fear losing control. Very often people fear losing control, believe it or not, it's related to early bowel training. One of the big ones.
Absolutely. That's a very common one. I think it is not the same to say that I'm going to fall apart, that I'm going to lose control. Control means I have a set of functions which I monitor, and I'm not going to be able to control them. Sometimes that means dominate them. Sometimes that means make them happen in a certain way. Falling apart means I'm going to fragment. And that's a different state.
It is a different one. But dealing with the first one, if you have a fear of losing control, go up to your room, lay down in a bed, and lose control. I mean, put a rubber sheet under yourself and lose control. If you have the fear of doing it, do it so you don't have to live in fear of it.
I think the fear is frequently, the fear is not of the actual moment of loss of control, but of the humiliation of the figure who's standing there watching this and saying something crushing or
But deflating. It's amazing to learn, because one of the things, again, that we take people through in therapy is, go ahead, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the place that you're afraid of. And very often people say, I can't go there. There is no chance that I would ever go there. But fearing it is what I'm holding on to.
Uh-huh.
And of course, if you fear losing control, who would be the most offended by you losing control? Whatever parent toilet trained you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well,
yes.
That's the person who's going to disapprove of you the most. Now let's talk about that other one, the fear of falling apart. It's such an amazing thing, because when you think about humans, when you think about that, we all come from a zygote, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that somewhere in the process of our formation, we were a fertilized egg that split in half. Right? Do you think there's any memory of that process of mitosis?
Question.
You know, can we remember on some level what it was like to be one and then split into two? How about that for being ripped apart? And then again, split into two twos,
mm-hmm.
right? And then split into four fours.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
That process, what's it like to be one and then be divided in two?
Sure, which is a process that goes on throughout life.
Throughout life. So when you think about people having to face divorce, right, you wonder, is there a memory from way back there that's saying if you split apart, if you separate, you're going to die? How many people do we know who are afraid of separation on all levels? They just can't tolerate separation.
Sure.
Is it possible? Well, it's real esoteric, but what do you think, Scott? Do you think that we have ways of having some body memory of these kind of painful experiences?
Well, I don't assume that they're painful, that experiences that are part of the developmental process are not necessarily painful. But whether we have some kind of recollection of them, I wouldn't be surprised at all. And again, it goes back to the issue of loving. Love is an evolutionary energy that enables the organism to make the attachment to the uterus, to form a blood pool. I mean, Stanley Kellerman has really talked about this extensively, and I think he's absolutely right. These are real anatomical functions, and the receptivity of the uterus, the receptivity of the mother, the experience of being one and then separate, everything you're talking about makes up part of our cellular memory. And I've had people talk about it, and I've had the experience myself of having to separate from an intrusive, possessive, dominating, controlling parent who's gotten inside the person's body, literally making the separation from that person one cell at a time, feeling like every cell has to be pulled away and made one's own. And again, I don't think that's totally metaphorical. I think there are probably biochemical and neurological activities going on that really reflect that. We don't know how to see it, and I don't know if even if we could see it in the reductionistic way, whether it would be the same as sharing the experience between two people of what that's like to go through.
There's so much of an argument about the nature of memory. You know, a lot of people remember early childhood sexual abuse, and some of it is a production in their mind, and it's not necessarily really happened. Some people don't remember it at all, and it did happen. And how far back does memory go? We used to believe that it was not possible to have memory if the sheath of the neuron was not myelinated, right? So it, but then they proved that that wasn't necessary either. You could have memory without myelinization of the sheath. And then Dr. Stan Grof came along. Do you know Stan's work?
Sure.
And he proposed a perinatal matrix. He said there are four potential ways that you were when you were in utero, and that these four potential ways, you could either be explosive, dying to get out of there. You could be implosive, waiting, not resenting it and not wanting to get out there, and different things he spoke about. And he said, and that's exactly the kind of person you become later. One day we'll have to do a program on his on his stuff. I knew
Invite
Stan
him
many
in.
Years
I think
ago.
That would be
Where
very
is he nowadays? He was married to Joan Halifax for a while.
I'm
and
sure he's doing something, breathing deeply.
Call him up,
somewhere.
Get him in here.
Right.
So there must be some kind of memory that affects us, and I believe it's in there. What kind of body are you? Are you a stiff body? Is there something wrong with you? Does it affect you on every level that you don't know? Does it affect some of your vital functions? And does it affect the way you love? The way you love. Are you in some way carrying some baggage that's manifested in your body that comes out intensely when you're in love? Let's say that you feel the deepest love possible for someone. Let's say for the first time you allow yourself to love. Let's say that you dip all the way inside, and the person who you've kept at a distance for so long, you embrace them. And you embrace them, and you let yourself love, and you feel the warmth of that, and then suddenly you can't get an erection. Suddenly you become sexually dysfunctional. Suddenly the person where you could have orgasms if it was a fast interaction with somebody, you can't come anymore. These sexual manifestations, when you become truly intimate for the first time, are so common. The number of people who consult with us about the fact that they're in a relationship and then suddenly sex dies, but they love more than ever before. Does that happen? I mean, isn't that amazing? You know how bewildering it is to love somebody and then not have your genitals work anymore? Have you seen this a great deal, Scott? Have you seen manifestations of sexual difficulty as a person approaches intimacy more?
Sure. The experience of intimacy is an experience of losing some of the rigidity of one's boundaries, and all the feelings that are there come up then. I think that people, in fact, this happened with a client of mine recently who was working very actively to say what she was feeling, and she felt thereby that she was being intimate. And it came to her attention, I think not only through me, that saying what you're feeling isn't being intimate. Being intimate is being receptive. It's taking in the other person. It's allowing them to come inside your body. And that's scary.
And when it happens, why would you turn off physically? Why would it manifest in that sexual kind of way?
Well, I think there are a number of answers to that. I think one of them is that we don't value and teach and help people to develop a refined sense of what it means to be intimate and what it means to be open. And so people are frequently unskilled in it, and they come to that moment and they really don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And to be aggressive in that moment, to love aggressively, to be aggressively tender, is not something we're really schooled in. And so it can feel like one is either being dangerous to the other person, the possibilities of rejection rise. The feeling of being loved in that moment, like the infant, where all the energy is pouring out, and the child is so powerful by virtue of their capacity to love at that moment, and all the parents' limitations and fears and anxieties are suddenly mobilized. It's not very different. There's a moment there of the possibility of a kind of union. For a moment. It doesn't have to last more than that. And at that moment, one sees the parent go, and back the child away. I think that pattern then happens the same way in adulthood.
For sure. Dr. Scott Baum, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. It becomes real difficult. One of the interesting things I find is that when people who are not trained on being in love, of course none of us are, fall in love, what people very often do think is, well, in order for me to be intimate, I have to control myself a lot because I'm sharing a relationship. It's true. Mm-hmm. I've got to put some new controls in. And one of the controls I'm going to do is I'm not going to get as angry as much as I would have if this person weren't so intimate with me. So I'm not going to express my anger. And one of the things that happen is you find out, you find yourself shutting down your anger in some way, and that manifests in impotence. One of the greatest treatments we have here, or one of the things that we do with people who are impotent, is we have them express their rage in the privacy of a therapy room. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it's amazing how quick the sexuality comes back. It's one of the ways of working with couples. Scott, I want to thank you for being with us. I know you've got to run off, but it's also coming to near the end of the program.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm going to look forward to this. So much to learn, huh, friends? It's always like this. So much to learn. Learning about loving, learning about how to love, learning about the body-mind. Once again, thanks to Scott Baum. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. I'm going to leave you with a little exquisite music. Just so that whatever piece of gratitude there is out there that you could grab for maybe having escaped the worst of the worst, maybe you could just say hello to the kid inside and say, we got through it.
Mm-hmm.